We've all had fierce and formidable women in our lives who have shaped who we are now. The Tech and Learning's Honor Roll podcast is dedicated to celebrating women who have shaped the education landscape more than you can possibly imagine. Who better to host this conversation than Drs. Keisha Ray and Frances Gibson, two fierce and formidable women who have been driving innovation in the field of the education world for more than 30 years. Please welcome our hosts, Drs. Keisha Ray and Frances Gibson.
Welcome to episode number 11 of Tech and Learning's Honor Roll, a podcast that celebrates fierce and formidable women in education. I'm Keisha Ray.
And I'm Frances Gibson. And I'm loving that 11 marks that we are officially 6 months in and strong with stories of determination, love, and equity. I cannot tell you how many fierce listeners have shared how much they love even just taking a walk and reflecting on these amazing stories. So today we have another fierce female with an incredible love story as well. In front of us today is Dr. Cynthia Lim. So let's learn a little bit more about Dr. Lim. Cynthia has over 20 years experience in student data and accountability systems in the LA Unified School District. As executive director for the Office of Data and Accountability, an office many of us are connected to, she was responsible for developing the metrics for strategic planning, administering state and district assessments, overseeing data reporting and analysis of school, and most importantly, student achievement. She managed a team of over 100 folks involved in design, development, and selection of the appropriate evaluation assessment tools for district accountability, as well as the approval of many, many, many research projects, I will say. Prior to LA Unified, Dr. Lim was a program specialist for the Los Angeles-Annenberg Metropolitan Project, LAMP, and a program analyst for the Independent Analysis Unit of the Board of Education in LA Unified. She received her BA in experimental psychology, definitely want to know more about that, from UC Santa Barbara, an MSW from UC Berkeley, and a PhD in social welfare from UCLA. She is the author of one of my new favorite books, Wherever You Are, a memoir of love, marriage, and brain injury, about her experience with caregiving for her disabled husband. She's currently working on her second memoir about her family's immigration history from China.
Oh my gosh, you are incredible already. And we haven't even asked you any questions, Dr. Lim. And you are definitely one of our sheroes in education. And as we explore our models of leadership together, we like to focus on what we call a pattern of M, asking our guests who their mentors are and how those mentors have impacted your life. And then we ask you to consider the mirrors and mentors. And then we will turn to movements and maverick moments. So it's going to be an amazing time hearing all of your M's today.
And Keisha, don't forget, we want to catch any edge babble we use to make sure our listening community connects with what is being said. And I caught one while introducing Cynthia. Cynthia, can you describe the work of this thing called LAMP? I've seen the acronym in many reform books.
Sure. And thank you for having me today. So, education, we love acronyms. So, you know, every program, everything we do, we condense to these cryptic letters. So LAMP stood for Los Angeles Annenberg Metropolitan Project. And it was really dealing with a gift from Walter Annenberg. I think it was back in the early 1990s, where he donated $500 million to public education nationwide, which was a very, very generous gift. And Los Angeles received about $53 million of that. And LAMP was created to distribute that money to schools in Los Angeles County, not just LA Unified, but Los Angeles County. So it was a wonderful experience of someone handing you money and saying, come up with your best ideas for how you can improve education. And so we were able to provide really great professional development opportunities for teachers. We were able to take people to like Boston and New York and visit other school districts that were doing really innovative things, things that you couldn't really do with, you know, public funds. So it was a great experience.
That does sound like a great experience. And what a bright program to be part of that offered incredible promise to the city of Los Angeles. And what a tremendous gift from the Annenbergs. Speaking of gifts, we're going to start with people who gave you the gift of being a role model. So can you share with us your role models, who they are and why?
Well, the first person that comes to mind is my maternal grandmother, because as Frances was saying, I'm working on my second memoir about my family history, immigration from China. And my maternal grandmother was born in China. And at the time that she lived in China, in the 1920s, women could not be educated. And so when she immigrated to the United States in the 50s and 60s, she was really, she helped raise me. She would always say, education is the most important thing because you don't know what it's like to not have that opportunity. So she grew up in this village in China where women were not educated. She said she would watch, the boys go off to school and feel really envious. And finally, when she was about 15, they hired a tutor for the girls in the village, and she was able to get 3 years of schooling. And she said in those 3 years, she learned to become literate. Like, she learned how to read and write Chinese, which is huge, because I just took this class at Santa Monica College on Chinese, learning to read it. I never learned how to read or write it. And I was completely lost, just like basic characters. And so I have even more admiration for her now, that her thirst for learning was so strong that she was able to, to learn enough to be able to read letters at the end of 3 years. So I never forgot that. And she always, always said, you don't know what it's like to live in a country where women can go to college, which, was unheard of in China. So she's my number one role model.
And grandmothers certainly are number one on both the list for Keisha and I. And I know that just that story of education, how impactful that is for so many, and your ability to honor her with her legacy and this memoir that you have coming up about your family must be an amazing process that just engages you in deep reflection. And as you think about those spaces of deep reflection that you go to and that have deeply impacted you, who have been some of your mentors in this journey?
Well, early on when I first started working in education, because I really wanted to go into social work, and on a lark, I answered this ad for an analyst for the Board of Education, the Independent Analysis Unit, when I first moved to LA. I was in my, mid-20s, really cocky, thought I knew everything. And so one of my first mentors was Roger Rasmussen, who was the director of the Independent Analysis Unit. And this unit reported directly to the Board of Education in LA Unified, because there was such distrust between the board and the staff. So they had their own little consulting group. And I think they've just resurrected that again in LA Unified. But so way back then, Roger Rasmussen was the director, and he wanted to bring people from different disciplines. He didn't want educators. He wanted people that could come in and offer like a different view. And so he's the one that really taught me how to write concise, simple policy memos or briefs. And it was phenomenal. And he was just such a great thinker. So I learned a lot from him. And then when I went to work for the Annenberg Foundation, Maria Casillas was the director of LAMP at the time. And she really taught me a lot about leading with an open heart. She was just, it was such a family feeling working there with that group of people. And just her management style was just so inclusive and, stern when she needed to be, but really giving staff a lot of freedom to think critically, freely. So I really admired that. And then when I came to LAUSD, I worked with Esther Wong, who was my predecessor in Office of Data and Accountability. She was the data guru for the district. I mean, like, everybody worshiped the ground that, Esther walked on. And what she taught me really was the value of relationships in a huge organization, because, you know, just being in a position doesn't mean that you could get things done. It's really the relationships that you develop with people along the way that make them want to collaborate with you, or you want to collaborate with them. So really, I think leadership is just all about those connections that you make of feeling like you're doing this together and you're not alone in this. And finally, Ray Cortinas, who was superintendent when I was at LAUSD for a brief time, he really taught me the value of speaking up, because, you know, culturally I was raised where you don't make a fuss, you don't toot your own horn, you don't speak up, right? And he would challenge me on a lot of those things. And through him, I learned how to like speak up and push back. So I think that's a really valuable lesson. And I think a lot of women don't get those kinds of lessons when you're coming up through the ranks, right? You're kind of taught to just be compliant.
Sad, but true. Sad but true. But lucky for you, you had these amazing mentors and role models that you could look up to. And I especially appreciate Esther Wong's kind of message about the value of relationships. I think sometimes when we get in leadership positions, we build walls around ourselves for a lot of different reasons. And sometimes that can actually be the most destructive thing you can do as a leader, is to wall yourself off and, you know, live in some kind of ivory tower while your, you know, staff are down there doing whatever. So at what point did you look in the mirror and see a leader looking back at you?
You know, that's a tough one, because I always thought of myself as a reluctant leader. I didn't feel like I was a leader. You know, I felt like I was placed in this position with a lot of responsibility and really no training on how do you lead, and, you know, how do you get people to follow what you have to say. So I always think that it's in those moments of crises that that I felt I was a leader and felt the weight of responsibility. So you know, I weathered that whole recession in 2008, 2009, and we had to cut so much of our staff. And I think that was the most painful part of my career and the most painful part of being a leader, of going through your staff list and realizing, you know, you're going to have to cut a lot of people. And how do you do that? And how do you do it in a humane way? So that was really hard. And I felt such a sense of responsibility for, you know, they're not just positions, they're people and their lives, and they have families and careers. And so that's when I really felt the weight of responsibility of being a leader. The other time was when we had to do active shooter training at the district, which that was such a painful experience. I mean, just the thought of having to conceive of the idea that somebody would come in and start shooting at your staff. And so I took that really, really to heart. Like, I had us look at everything on our floor. I had them look at all the locks in any of the offices that we had. And I really, I did follow-up sessions with the staff to say, This is a real thing. Where are each of you going to retreat if this happens? And so that's when I really felt the weight of responsibility. It's like, oh my God, I have to do everything under my power to make sure that people are safe. And I think that's the, you know, the flip side of being a leader, is that you feel that heavy sense of responsibility for the welfare of everyone on your staff.
Definitely those messages of your mentors around courage, relationship, and speaking up were definitely things that you saw in the mirror with yourself. And as you think about a time where we are right now with scarce resources and yet we need abundant thinking, you modeled that so beautifully as a leader for your team. And I'm wondering, as you situate yourself as a female in that role, as you mentioned earlier, just some of the those reluctant moments, what are some ways that you do see women changing the world? What are some of your insights around that?
Well, see, I think women have always changed the world. I think we're just getting acknowledged for it now, because I see the difference in women leaders. I think a lot of times women leaders are more compassionate, or I think especially, you know, if you've raised a family and stuff, I used to kind of envision being a leader that way. It was like being a mom and just managing a lot of kids, right? And knowing like which person is going to need a little bit of help in this area and which person hasn't and can just go. I think that's really, it sounds sexist to say it's a kind of a woman thing that you would have that intuition, but maybe it's not, I don't know. But I really think that women bring that sense of multitasking because we've been doing it all our lives, right?
It's so true. And, you know, like you said, I think females have been doing a lot of the work for many years and probably not getting enough credit for it. But it seems like, you know, 2020, 2021, like COVID just kind of unveiled this amazing awareness of, oh, we have all these female women leading these countries that have actually figured out a better way of managing a pandemic. And then, you know, the NASDAQ CEO is a female, Adina Friedman, and she unveiled a plan to increase the representation of women and underserved minorities on the boards of NASDAQ listed companies. So I feel like not only is there a greater awareness, but, you know, kind of like we're trying to do in the honor roll, there's a greater push for acknowledgement and kind of leading people to the table, so to speak. So who are you watching? What kind of female mavericks are you watching?
Well, I love that we have a female vice president and a woman of color. I love that we have a first lady that's an educator. And so I'm really watching what Joe Biden does, because I think that's such a wonderful role model for everyone, that you could be first lady and you could still teach full time. So I am so thrilled that we have women in those positions right now.
Yeah, I love that too. And let's say Dr. Biden again, right? Emphasizing that doctor. You supported students that you and I both care deeply around with our LA's Promise, part of the larger frame of the College Promise to create cities of graduates. And what I recall from connecting with her is that she was incredibly personable, graceful, strong, and bold. And I just thought, this is the person that I want to see leading even more. And I'm so happy to see her in that space today. And she also reminded us as she spoke with our high school students about this important awareness of taking care of ourselves. And so as leaders and really thinking about yourself as a leader, what are some self-care recommendations you might advocate for or ideas that you might share with us?
Well, I think one is to don't feel guilty for taking care of yourself. I think that's a lesson that we never learn. So when I was working at LAUSD, you know, my husband had this brain injury. He was pretty severely disabled, and I had a caregiver at home when he worked. And so I felt, you know, I worked these really long days at LAUSD, then I would come home and care for my husband. And through that journey, I learned like I needed days off. I needed time for myself. So I would take trips by myself, you know, like to visit our sons. I have a son in New York and one that was in Arizona at the time. But it was important to just take that time out for myself. But it's a really hard lesson to learn because you don't feel like you're entitled to that because you have all these responsibilities. But I think one of the first things I had to learn was stop feeling guilty. You deserve this, right? Like you need that trip to the spa. You need to just take time out for yourself. As selfish as it seems, it's really necessary.
That's something I've struggled with, Cynthia, as a new mom. I don't do that very well at all. And every week that we're on with a guest, they always have amazing advice and, you know, kind of preach the self-care. And I think it's so important for people like me to hear that it's okay to, you know, get a pedicure. Yeah. It's all right. You don't have to walk around without a bath. Now we're going to transition to a little game we play that we ask you to kind of finish a sentence or a thought. And the first one is an event that changed my worldview.
Well, I've mentioned before, it was my husband. My husband was 47. He had a heart attack and he didn't get enough oxygen to his brain. And, you know, up until then, we had this really idyllic life. You know, I worked at the district. He was an attorney in this big law firm. And we had two teenage sons. We were really happy. And overnight, you know, our world changed, because when he woke from his coma of 2 weeks, he was a completely different person and he could never go back to work. And he was very disabled, cognitively impaired, but he always recognized me. He always recognized our sons. And so we learned how to embrace what was there and embrace this new life, because you know, otherwise we would have just been just drowning in sorrow the whole time, right? Because you mourn what was lost. But that really made me think about all that we did have, not what we lost, but what was still there and what could we still do. And so that changed me. It changed my sons about how we view the world. It's like every day is a gift.
Yeah, powerful. You know, I have one of those connected sentence starters too, Cynthia. And before I share this sentence starter with you, I have this picture of you from your retirement. We put on those incredible Hulk hands on. Do you remember that? Yes. So we put our hands, yes, and then our hands became incredible Hulk hands. And we were like, like these two strong, fierce women. So I have that in my mind as I ask you this question or this provide you the sentence starter, I should say. But I know it has multiple meanings. So just a fun connection there and this reminder around strength. And so the sentence starter is, I became a stronger person after. What do your Hulk hands look like?
Well, I became a stronger person after retirement physically, because I work out with this trainer and we actually do boxing. So I've become quite a good boxer. But, you know, I think I became a much stronger person after dealing with this ordeal with my husband. It was a whole separate life from my work life. So, you know, at home, I faced all this uncertainty around brain injury and what the course of his illness was going to be, what the next steps were for him. And it was just so tinged with uncertainty. Like, nobody really knew what was going to come back or if anything would come back. And so I would escape to work because that was certain. Like, I could deal with numbers and I could deal with these facts that never change. So that was a good balance. It's like the uncertainty of disability at home versus the certainty of facts and data at work. So those two things really merged, but I don't think I answered your question.
That was the question answer we needed to hear.
There are no right, every answer you give is the right answer, my friend. Wonderful one. So I have another question. You did so good on that one. My life improved when I...
when I retired in 2017. It's really sad to say. No, you know, I love the work that I did at LUSD. I love the people there. Nothing can compare to those times where you're sitting in a room with colleagues and you're brainstorming and you're coming up with solutions that you know are going to help kids. It was very, very fulfilling. But my life did improve after retirement because I realized how much of it was, you know, you just put on the blinders and you go to work And Francis knows this. We used to put in very long hours at work. And really, you know, I'd leave my house at 7 a.m. and come home at 7:30 at night. And during the winter, it was like I never saw my house during daylight, right? So after retiring, I realized, oh my God, there's this whole world out here that I had no idea, you know, like how peaceful my neighborhood is during the day and all the people that walk their dogs and, you know, all my regular neighbors in the neighborhood. I mean, that was great. So I think it was just slowing down and actually realizing work is very important, but there's a life outside of work too.
Yeah. So for all those listeners who are working 14 and 16 hour days, a reminder that yes, retirement is wonderful and it's ahead of us, but the question is how might we use some of those strategies now, today, to fully embrace the life that we are leading? And what are some things that you would say in addition to that, that are some decisions that changed your life when you kind of pinpoint down to this notion of a decision?
You know, that was a hard one because I don't think that life is just a series of decisions. Mm-hmm. So I can't think of one, you know, one big decision that changed my life. I think it's just a series of them. I mean, one of the decisions I made early on in my career was to stay home with my kids when they were really, really young. And at the time I felt so inadequate because it was like, oh my God, what about my career? And I've gone to school all these years and what's going to happen? And then you realize it goes by so quick. It goes by so quick. And I'm, you know, in retrospect, I'm glad that I took that time because they're never going to be that age again.
Yeah. So you really highlighted for us the importance of this like constellation of decisions, right? And the notion that it's not just the North Star, that one decision that sometimes lights up the entire night sky, but it's really how the constellation connects all of these pieces together. You know, your stories have been so powerful about just things that we could do now in the moment, trajectories looking forward, and really this weaving of networks of support, of love, of courage, and really this space of identity. And I know I can't wait to read your next book. And I'm just waiting for it to be released. And Keisha, I'm wondering, today's your first time meeting Cynthia. What are you learning about Dr. Lim?
Well, you have incredible power of endurance and strength. I'm incredibly impressed by that. The work that you've done throughout your career and the impact that you've had on the students and the children throughout the entire city of LA is just, you know, immeasurable. And the dedication that you've shown for your husband in the face of incredible challenges. I love what you said about retirement. My favorite thing when I retired was to eat lunch with friends and order a drink. And stay as long as I wanted. And then, of course, I had a baby. So you are an inspiration to us all. And you've probably started a lot of folks thinking about what they're going to do in their retirement, and challenging them to become notable authors is one thing that I think you've done today. So I'm wondering, do you have any final thoughts that you want to share with our audience? Something that you might even tell your younger self or a student?
Well, you know, I would tell my younger self to slow down and enjoy it and don't worry so much. I think, you know, in your 20s, you're so worried about your career, and in your 30s, it's like, what am I going to be when I grow up? And then when you finally grow up, you know, you realize it in your 40s and 50s. But, you know, I wish I could tell my younger self in my 20s, like, it's okay. It's okay. Don't fret so much. It'll all work out. You know, I think about my grandmother, again, my maternal grandmother, when I was wrestling with the idea of staying home with my kids, you know, when they were young. And she said something like, you know, you have the rest of your life to work, but your kids are only going to be this age once. And so I thought that was great advice that, you know, if you think like, I know so many women wrestle with motherhood, working, that sort of thing. But really, It's such a short time that you have to raise your kids. It's 18 years. And looking back, it's like that went by in a flash, you know? So yeah, enjoy it while it's there.
Wise words.
Indeed. We need to savor each and every one of those moments. And I'm thinking right now, what are our listeners reflecting on with just these powerful experiences and your stories? And as always, Keisha, you know, I've got one of those coaching questions ready.
Sure.
But I have a little assistance this time. So this week's coaching question comes directly from the praise section of your book, Cynthia, a beautiful, beautiful memoir titled Wherever You Are. And the question that one of your reviewers wrote is, what makes a life worth living? What makes a life worth living? And I echo the words of this reviewer when she states this, that your book, your words, the words we've heard today, she said, are written through a love story lens of a courageous woman who finds the capacity to experience joy and love in the face of devastating loss. And as I shared with you, when I picked up the book, I read it entirely in one setting. I was enamored with your message, and I hope that our listeners will continue to learn more about your leadership, both in your family setting and in the greater Los Angeles community. You have had a love story, not only in your home, but for the children that you serve.
Mm-hmm. It's so true. And thank you for sharing that story with us today and with our listeners. We can't thank you enough for just spending a little bit of your time with us and sharing your wisdom and your story.
Indeed. And we want you, Cynthia, to know that we will continue to wander alongside you, along with our readers and listeners. And in the words of Jenny Nash, the reviewer from the Chief Creative Officer of Author Accelerator in your book, she said that you make us all wonder, would I be brave, that strong, and that full of joy?
Well, I'm going to challenge our listeners to respond to Frances's coaching question on Twitter with our hashtag TL Honor Roll, R-O-L-E. So it's hashtag TL Honor Roll, R-O-L-E. And please join us for our next podcast where we're highlighting another Shiro in education and exploring their M's. And until then,
be fierce
and be formidable.
The Tech and Learning's Honor Roll podcast is produced by Keisha Ray, Frances Gibson, and Christine Weiser. Audio production by Mitchell Tulin and AV Nation. Tech and Learning's Honor Roll theme music is by Madison Van Gundy. Find more episodes on techlearning.com and follow us at hashtag TL Honor Roll. That's TL Honor, R-O-L-E.